We are chatting art, transport, communications, history. That's CATCH. I call it, for some strange reason, the Catchcast. And we're hoping to get you as fascinated by our lovely geeky subjects as myself and the guests. And in this edition, a telephone exchange that was kept hidden for decades. How it was built as a bomb shelter. Its connection to James Bond, and a voice that you'll recognise who worked there for many years. Today we're talking about the secret Kingsway telephone exchange with none other than Vectis radio presenter Kelvin Curry. Welcome to the Catchcast, Kelvin.
Oh, welcome. Thank you very much, Mark.
And who knew you had this fascinating mystery life?
Well, it was a few years ago. It's not something I talk about openly. Not that there's anything particularly secret about that place now, but it was a big chunk of my early years as a telephone engineer.
Now, before we sort of really get stuck into it, I just wonder if you could talk us a bit through how it was all created and why this Kingsway Exchange was set up in the first place.
Right. As you'll be aware with all these things, there's a number of theories, but from my own experience, it was meant to be a deep level, full-sized train tunnel. The reason I say that, a bit like the Elizabeth line is now, but obviously way back before the Second World War, all the tunnel linings and the main two tunnels were all marked LPTB, London Passenger Transport Board. Mm. So, but of course, the war came along and I believe it was turned into a deep level shelter for the purposes of the Second World War.
And there were also plans for other, I didn't know about the one underneath the central line, but there was also a plan to run north-south, wasn't there, underneath the northern line, and some of those became shelters too.
I know there are shelters at a place like Good Street. I don't know if they were part of that or not, but certainly they were built as part of the transport network rather than anything else. In the same way that some parts of the eastern parts of the central line, which are underground, have actually turned into a factory during the Second World War. But that's a separate topic.
So did the Kingsway tunnels ever get used as an air raid shelter?
Well, I believe they did. There were some diagrams I saw when I worked there, which had HODS, Home Office Deep Shelter, and it showed them as having a split level along both of the tubes with facilities like toilets and water points and things like that.
And also, I think it was requisitioned at some point by Whitehall as a kind of communications centre.
I'm not sure about during the Second World War, but certainly when I worked at it, which was in the 1970s, it was completely a telephone exchange communications centre, yes.
Mm-hmm. And just after the war itself, after 1945, suddenly London and perhaps other cities as well had these deep level shelters, and they didn't really have any purpose. I think there was some storage purpose that was used for, wasn't it?
Yes, they were. I mean, the Good Street one turned into a document storage facility. There are others around the country in Manchester and Birmingham and places like that. And there are a couple of deep level ones which are in other parts of the south that I'm still not allowed to tell you about.
And so this idea of burying cables deep underground, is that because they were susceptible if they were above ground to some kind of nuclear attack or something?
Well, no, it's a bit more practical than that. Burying cables underground en masse is a lot less of a maintenance risk, because you generally don't get Fred with his JCB digging through them, because they're that much further down. And there is a deep level network of cables under London. It is a proof against attack, but it's more to do with, if you ever tried the expense of running new cable ductwork through London, it's going to be really expensive. So deep level tunnels are much better for it.
And I think I read as well that the idea of converting to some kind of telephone exchange happened in the, perhaps at the end of the storage period, at the end of the 1940s. So I wonder what work the post office, the GPO, did to sort of repurpose those tunnels to fit into being a telephone exchange.
Well, the tunnels were completely stripped out, as far as I understand, and a proper floor put in. As I say, they would have originally been designed to take a full-size mainline train, electrically driven, of course. But so they put a proper floor in, and then there was lots of power, and there's an artesian well down there to provide the water. And they built a number of other tunnels heading off to one side, all of which had GPO on the tunnel lining, so you could tell which ones they were. And in that section, they put the switching equipment. And the section I worked in, which was one of the long tunnels, the North Tunnel, as it was called, had all the long-distance transmission equipment in it.
Right, we're going to come on to some juicy details of when you worked there as well, Kelvin. But I just wonder how much work it must have been to cut all these extra new tunnels out to make it into an exchange. I mean, what did they do with the soil, I wonder?
Well, that's something I've never managed to figure out. I mean, if you look at the tunnels, they were clearly created by the Great Head Shield method. So they must have dug a huge hole somewhere and dropped it down there to get those tunnels in. So they don't actually end up above ground. They just stop.
Mm.
So I know you can dismantle these things and take them out. I mean, the main tunnels are actually connected to Chancery Lane Station. There's a connection, which until not long before I started, you could actually still get through. But I'm guessing that's the way they got the equipment in and the spoil out, probably at night.
And there was also, I think, an entrance, wasn't there, on Chancery Lane itself?
Well, the entrance that I used when I was there, and the main entrance was on Chancery Lane, in the old original surface buildings for the Central London Railway's Chancery Lane Station, because the entrance that's there now is a bit further to the east and is a buried one, whereas this was the original. If you look at the architecture of it, you can see that it's a Central London Railway architecture style. But there are two other entrances which were added later, on some of the streets to the south of Holborn, and one was in Furnival Street and the other was in Tookes Court.
So there were certainly ways down, but in order to get everything out to build the extra tunnels, there must have been a hell of a lot of soil, wasn't there, really? I wonder what they did with it all.
I've no idea where it went, in the same way that I've no idea what happened to the soil that they dug out for most of the underground. It must have gone somewhere, mustn't it?
I read somewhere that they did use it to create some artificial islands further up the Thames estuary, somewhere near Essex. Yeah, yeah. Now, I'm taking you back a little bit to the wartime role, and I believe that it was the Special Operations Executive of MI6, which was in the Kingsway Tunnels before your time. I wonder if you know anything about one of their secret employees at all, Kelvin.
You mentioned Ian Fleming. I think he was an employee of Special Intelligence Services, whatever they were called back then, wasn't he?
Yes, that's who I'm referring to.
Yeah, and he based a lot of his novels, the ones he wrote, not necessarily the later films, the ones he wrote were based on his experiences, let's put it that way.
And I understand that he got inspiration for Q Branch Laboratories from those very tunnels.
Wouldn't surprise me in the least. I mean, there was no trace of anything like that there when I was in there, but there were lots of stories about what used to happen. And yes, I wouldn't be at all surprised. They were there during the war. They were pretty safe from conventional bombing. And it was a good place to put it.
And you referred to some great stories that you heard when you were there. Did you hear anything about what life was like there before the exchange was opened?
Only that it was pretty unpleasant. I mean, it was a big old tunnel, but the ventilation wasn't good. You have to remember, back in those days, everybody smoked.
Mm.
So if you spent your night in there, you came out with very little fresh air to breathe.
You were basically kippered in a tunnel.
Yeah, I think so, yes.
So these deep-level tunnels were converted into a sort of secret Cold War bomb-proof telephone exchange by the early 1950s. And yes, I understand they were also linked to similar facilities outside London, Kelvin.
Yeah, there were a number of similar type of establishments in the larger cities, some of which are known and some of which are still quite, not restricted, but I'd rather not mention the names of where they are. But it was, the height of the Cold War, I suppose, then, and they were doing things that we would need to do should there be some kind of attack. But that didn't happen in that way. But the deep level system that I worked in was designed to be self-sufficient.
Yeah, we'll come on to how that worked in a second, but that Cold War above ground, it really was deepening at that point, wasn't there? What innovation did they introduce that came through the Kingsway Exchange?
We had a couple of things in there. We had a number of the circuits that the BBC used for broadcast so that they would still be working, as it were. Oh, a lot of long-distance stuff. There was some military stuff that went through there, part of the early warning system. You remember those big domes they used to have up at Filing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, those circuits came through where I worked and had special had special markings on the racks and things, so you knew which ones they were. They all came through the Kingsway Exchange, and it was a centre of long-distance communications and military stuff as well. And I'm told, but I can't guarantee it's true, I'm told that's where the transatlantic Prime Minister phone went to the American President.
Ah, yes. Wasn't it called something like TAT-1, the Transatlantic Coax Cable?
TAT-1 was one of the early transatlantic cables. I mean, there'd been transatlantic cables before that, but they were telegraph only. This was one of the early actual voice ones. And there was some stuff there that was used on those. But most of the complicated stuff for those was power feeding, which was done at the coastal stations, not where we were.
But it's amazing that the president's hotline came right through the middle of this exchange.
Well, yes, it did. And, of course, if you recall that the war rooms were also a converted underground station, weren't they, not too far away?
Ah, yes, Downstreet.
Downstreet, yes. And that's all still there. Now, I think you can visit it nowadays as a tourist attraction, but certainly Downstreet was not too far away. And it's not too much of a stretch to imagine the cables leaving Kingsway and going through the tube network down there, is it really?
No, absolutely. And there was a whole network of underground cables that were connected to Kingsway, wasn't there?
Oh, yes, there were. There's an underground cable network which connected to Kingsway and to other major telecommunications buildings in central London.
Now, coming back to the secret tunnels themselves, if it were supposed to be staffed in the event of some awful major surface catastrophe, did that mean that people would have to literally sleep and live down there?
Yes, that was the intention. There were rudimentary accommodation arrangements, let's put it that way. Obviously, there's loos, there was water. I'm told there was a store of food, but I never actually saw it. More importantly, there was a bar. But you could survive down there. And the air was carefully recirculated. One or two of my colleagues at the time used to like being down there because they suffered from hay fever and there was no pollen in the air that went through that tunnel.
Wow, they must have been powerful filters then.
Oh, yes.
But not enough to filter out people's cigarette smoke.
Well, this is after, if you consider the wartime use as a shelter, there would have been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people in there. But as a telephone exchange, we had maybe 150 people, so it wasn't that much in terms of pollution from human breath or whatever, as it would have been when it was a shelter.
But 150 people stuffed below ground in some tunnels with not a lot of air inside, that must have been quite claustrophobic at times.
You know, people say that. I never found it so. It was painted, painted brightly. It was magnolia, but it was painted white. We had money available to buy things like fish tanks and so that we could have some movement and water and things. And the only thing you really noticed was you had no idea what the weather was doing. So when you wanted to pop out at lunchtime, you had to ring the doorman up and ask him what the weather was doing.
Make sure you got your brolly.
Do I need a coat? Is it hot? What's going on?
So how long did the exchange operate for? And when did you get your first visit there, Kelvin?
Well, as you say, I think it was converted to exchange in the 1950s, and some of that equipment was still there when I started there in the mid-1970s. Mm. And I did 3 or 4 years, a bit more than that there, till the early 80s. And I had a great time down there. I spent my time as a technician and then a technical officer down there, but as I moved up through the ranks.
So without breaking any state secrets, what did your job involve doing down there, Kelvin?
Oh, well, it's just simple maintenance. I was on long-distance networks, and so we would simply get something. Somebody would call in and say, we're not getting service from such and such a point in Britain to another point in Britain. They've sent a tone. You're familiar with broadcast. They send tones. Mm. And I'd get that on the record card, and it was all paper, a record card, see where that was supposed to appear in the Kingsway Exchange, and go through whether it was leaving us properly. And then, like I say, it's leaving here, so you need to talk to the next guy along. Or, no, I found it, there's a problem with a valve somewhere or something like that. So it was just maintenance and routine stuff on the equipment to make sure it's kept up to spec.
Wow. So, Kelvin, when did you begin working at the secret Kingsway Telephone Exchange? What was your job like apart from fixing things? What was every day like? Have you got some good stories for us?
Yeah, I've got some good stories. I started there. When I started with the post office as a telephone engineer, it was a 3-year apprenticeship, and you could choose where you wanted to spend your 3rd year. And I chose that because I thought it was going to be brilliant, and it was. And you're working in something a bit different from the ordinary thing. So, yes, it was making sure things worked, liaising with other people on the network and making sure everything went the way it should, and learning how to do that. But in terms of everyday stuff, well, it had all the things you needed. It had a canteen, which did, you know, the full range of things that a works canteen would do. I used to travel in on the central line, and because so that we used to be able to get through from the central line at Chancery Lane, but they bricked that up because apparently it is alleged people were skipping their fares. So, but I know where the connection was, and you'd walk in, and where I worked, you'd turn down the tube, and you'd be walking east past some huge generators. I mean, these were big guys, which weren't running; they were there for standby. Mm. And there, you could, until recently, you could see all their exhaust pipes in on the surface around the corner. So some of the little things that come to mind were, we used to do fire drills, so you'd have to leave the building by climbing up a ladder, which was a long way up. They'd come out of different exits. So you'd come out of the one, what I said was in Took's Court, which is in the middle of a load of offices. And all of a sudden, 150 people would appear from nowhere in this street. And you'd see all the people in the offices looking out there and going, what? Where'd they come from? Because it would look like a fire exit from an ordinary building, but it was actually a fire exit from underground.
And very, very important thing to do as well, if you're sort of stuck in tunnels. Yeah. You've got to be constantly aware of fire and all that hot equipment.
Constantly aware of fire, and we also had a section, well, they used to call the power section, the people that looked after everything that required heavy power, the generators and the lifts and things like that. And I can say that because one of the lifts was required as a fire lift, so there were one or two people who wouldn't have been able to climb up the ladders, the lifts must never break down, and they never did. One of the things that people used to get up to on nights, because it was 24-hour staffed, was the central line ran above it. You could hear the trains, you know, clattering above. Mm. But at night, when the central line had finished, there were people used to come along and tap the rail chairs to check for damage and cracking and things like that. And if you were feeling particularly devilish, you could bang back because they didn't know we were there.
So annoying to London Transport engineers was a great fun jape.
It was great fun. Well, they didn't know it was there. And they'd tap and you'd tap back and then you'd hear a pause. Because they weren't tapping, then they tap again, you tap back, and you think, you know, we're going to give them a heart attack if we're not careful, we'll just leave it alone for now.
Brilliant. How many years did you work there for, Kelvin?
4 or 5 years, I think, I was down there. Then I got moved off to go to university to do a degree, so I left there and then came back with a different role. But yeah, I had a brilliant time down there. It was a great team, and because it was different, it was a bit special.
Now, I'm going to ask you a super geeky question. We did a show, Catchcast, the first one actually, about telephone history, and I wonder if you can enlighten us a bit more about this. That exchange you worked at was in use during some big major changes to Britain's phone numbers, wasn't it? Those old telephones numbers like Whitehall 1234, that sort of style, that all went, didn't it, in the mid-1960s?
Yeah, I mean, there was a couple of things that happened. First off, the systems used in London and other bigger cities, or was used before we went electronic, was called the director system, and you had the prefix 3 digits. Now, they were originally prefixed with 3 letters, so Camden was CAM and Euston was EUS and all the rest of it. But the expansion of the phone system was such that there weren't enough letter combinations to make any more sense. Oh. So they dropped the letters so that you had just numbers. So you had, well, I mean, in fact, Kingsway Exchange had its own code, 353. But that was part of it. Then there was the what they used to call subscriber trunk dialing, STD, which is where we moved away from having to contact a long-distance operator to connect you to somewhere up country. Mm-hmm. Now, that used to be quite a normal thing. Depending on where you lived, you'd pick up the phone and dial a long-distance number, and an operator was answering, saying, number, please, they said, I'd like to talk to Birmingham. They'd put you through to Birmingham. The operator in Birmingham put you through to the number you wanted. Mm. And that was labour-intensive, as you can imagine. Mm. So as the technology rolled out, we moved to subscriber trunk dialing and give everybody a national code. And so that was the big change in terms of what happened technically.
There was also the ability to dial international numbers, wasn't there? That came about the same time.
Yeah, international numbers came around the same sort of time, so you could dial. The international dialing code system was set up, so you know that UK's 44 and America and Canada and one of the places over there is 1 and so forth. Having people physically answering calls is an expensive business. Mm. It also takes up a lot of space. And you try and keep these costs under control, and everything was largely automated by then.
Must have been a lot of out-of-work telephone operators around that time.
To an extent. I mean, it was planned. You could see it coming, and they just moved on to slightly different duties. Mm. you know, what we could do is do our best with them.
Now, I remember when IDD started, because I'm old enough to remember it, and I was a complete naughty boy at that period. And I remember finding the telephone numbers of record companies in America and using mum and dad's phone to dial 0101 so that you could dial through directly to New York at that time, and you know, getting on the phone to these companies and trying to blag freebie records out of them, which I managed to do. But then, of course, the phone bills came through and I was in a lot of trouble.
I bet you were. I certainly didn't do that, but you could make international calls from where I work without anybody paying the slightest bit of attention to it because we didn't get a bill.
So you left the exchange. What year was that then, Kelvin, that you left, and what did you do afterwards?
Partly left in 1976. So I went to university for 3 years, but I came back during the holidays and stuff. And then I came back there in 1980 and did a year or two more in there as a management and then got moved on.
And BT basically ended up closing it down for the uses. It became redundant at some point.
It became redundant. I mean, what happened was, to largely digital stuff came along, and it takes up a lot less space. I mean, and it doesn't need to be anywhere particular. And the stuff that was down there was so old that it was not worth replacing. I mean, it was all old valves. I've worked on valves for years and years and years.
Wow.
It became redundant because, like many places, you didn't need that much space for telecommunications equipment anymore.
And has the site been literally unused since it became abandoned?
As far as I know, yes. I mean, I saw some video of it a while back, and it looks like it's just been stripped out and left. I think it's still powered up, and I think you can still go into it, but there's nothing there. The only bit I recognised from my time there was the bar.
Not that you spend much time in those places, obviously.
No. But I mean, the bar's an interesting little story, actually. We started that as part of the social club down there. And the brewery that we had came along and said, right, you've got three entrances. Two of them are in the City of London. They won't give you a club licence because all the people on the council are publicans. So we'll have to put the licence for the one that's in the borough of Camden. And then you'll get it.
By hook or by crook, you got your beer.
Yeah.
Now, it sounds like an incredible space. Do you know anything about what's going to happen to it in the future?
I saw something recently that's going to be turned into some kind of tourist attraction, but I don't know. I mean, I know the post office railway got turned into a tourist attraction. I can't see why this wouldn't, but I'm not quite sure what you'd put down there, to be honest.
I found something when I was doing some research for this about a company trying to turn it into an interactive cultural experience, Kelvin.
Okay, well, good luck to them. I hope they do. I'd like to see you rather than just sitting there using up power. And, you know, I mean, it is going to be still connected to some stuff. They're not going to be allowed to go tunnels and that lead off of it. But I'm sure they can do something with it.
Well, look, when it opens, we'll have to get a joint ticket and go and explore. And you can tell us where the really secret bits are.
Yeah, I can point it out. Oh, over there used to be such and such. Yes, I can do all that. That's not a problem.
This has been a fascinating deep dive into the deeper tunnels and secret worlds. Who knew that Kelvin Curry himself had such a dark past? Many thanks to Kelvin for revealing that incredible history.
Well, thank you, Mark, for the opportunity to talk about it.
Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. Please join us then. But